This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Bank Tower in Baton Rouge. And your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And we are 13 days away from the presidential election. And we will talk about it with two seasoned politicos, one from the right side of the spectrum in Quinn Hillier and the other from the left in Bob Mann. Quinn's in Mobile, and Bob is a liberal in London, getting the view of people across the pond about the American presidential election. Again, your number 877-217-5757. Before we start, a reminder that this morning any donation to WRKF will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $3,000, and thanks to a group of members or donors through the Member Challenge Fund for making this possible. And WRKF, come January, will be 45 years young, and it is you, the public and public radio, that makes the trains roll. So again, if you'd like to be a member of the family, if you've not joined before, we'd want you to become a part of us. And if not, if it's time to renew, please do so. And you can do so at WRKF.org or give us a call at 855-893-9753. Again, 877-217-5757 for us. 13 days out. And the conventional wisdom by a lot of pundits is that Kamala Harris will close well and win the election. But the betting odds in Las Vegas do not reflect this. I mentioned the Real Clear Politics numbers, which now has Trump a 61% favorite to win the election. But that is consistent with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 other betting operations in Las Vegas. The lowest Trump is, as far as the odds of him winning in Vegas. And these people, of course, they're not accustomed to just putting out numbers for numbers' sake. They're actually placing bets. 59%. So Trump is the favorite in this race, 13 days out. And Quinn Hillier, who has been on the Trump watch, maybe on the watch list now, but he's been watching the former president since he announced his candidacy in Mobile, Alabama in 2015, and he has not been a fan of Donald Trump, but he's no fan of Kamala Harris either, and he is always a good guest, but particularly somebody who has critical views of both candidates. First of all, Quinn, how do you see the race, and how do you see the candidates in the home stretch?
I see a nail biter. I think that anybody who expresses confidence in the result either way right now is sort of foolish. There are all sorts of things pointing Trump's way. There are also a number of things pointing Kamala Harris's way. And I know it sounds like a wishy-washy answer, but this really could be a nail-biter. And there is perhaps the best chance I have ever seen of a 269-269 electoral college tie. I'm not predicting that, but it is absolutely well within the range of reason, and I can explore that with y'all later.
Well, we've actually gone there, and if Harris wins in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and Trump wins in North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, and Trump carries the congressional seat in Omaha, then it's 269 even, and it goes to the House, and the House almost certainly would make Donald Trump the president. Let's hope for the country's sake that it's not that close, that whoever wins by a comfortable margin. But Bob Mann, it is amazing. Our friend James Carville, you would think that Harris was 10 points in front, but she's not. She's behind, according to those who follow this. And it becomes a turnout election, and who will energize his or her base better? How do you see it, Bob?
Well, good morning, Jim, or afternoon from London. I think that, I agree with Quinn, who, by the way, I have a lot of respect for because he's been willing to speak out and oppose Trump and Trumpism in general for a long time. And I'm sure he's suffered a lot among his conservative friends and admirers who don't agree with him. So I have just a lot of respect for him, and I've told him that before. But I think that I agree. It's on a nice edge. It could go either way. We don't know what the, you know, we see the polling, and depending on what polling you're looking at, what polling average you're looking at, one is ahead of the other in almost every state, or it's completely tied in every state. My sense, you know, James Carville, as you just mentioned, has a piece in the New York Times this morning expressing confidence that Kamala Harris will win, and I think he's probably right, but not for the reasons that he articulated, which I think he left out an important factor, which I think has driven all the elections since the Dobbs decision in 2022, and that is the energy that exists on the pro-reproductive rights side. Women are just really, women and their allies on this issue have been really motivated to vote in almost every election, and there are, this is the first presidential election since the Dobbs decision, so I think it, when it's all over, if Harris wins, I think we may analyze it that the Dobbs decision had a lot more influence on it than anything about, you know, I'm as motivated by that as I am about saving democracy. But I think the Dobbs decision motivates a lot of people to get out and vote who might not otherwise vote and who might not otherwise vote for Harris.
Quinn, do you share that view?
I don't think the Dobbs decision is going to play as heavily as Bob does, and the respect is mutual, by the way. But I do think it is an element right now working somewhat in Kamala Harris's favor. And you know, it's one of several elements working in her favor. I think Trump people, in their own bubble, I think both candidates have supporters in a bubble, but the Trump bubble completely underestimates the passion of people in the middle who are absolutely frightened to death of Trump. And the Trump bubble can't even understand that viewpoint, despite all of the evidence that would actually give people reason to worry about Trump. And I think that the middle and like suburbia is going to be more pro Harris or less pro Trump, depending on which suburbs, than the Trump people think. I think that is going to make up for some of the Las Vegas type odds makers, sort of calculations right now. That's why I think it's actually, as I say, a knife's edge race.
Well, Bob, Trump, I'm sure, has been advised not to be as bombastic as he has been and to get off script and talk about Arnold Palmer rather than the economy or other matters. How's it playing in London right now?
Well, the people that I've talked to over here, and I'm not saying that I've done a representative sample of people in the UK, but everybody that I've talked to is really, they're really worried. And I think over here, particularly on this side of the Atlantic, people from the UK through the Western Europe and Eastern Europe are concerned more about the Trump's commitment or lack of commitment to the NATO alliance and what that means, not only in Ukraine and the future of that war, but if Trump withdraws from NATO or withdraws American support from Ukraine and Ukraine falls to Putin, that Putin's avarice for the rest of, for Poland and, mm-hmm. and some of the other countries on the edge, might not be so pleasant for people, even in places that are relatively very safe, like London, that might be sucked into a wider war over time. So they're just they're worried about the potential for, you know, the complete dissolution of the NATO alliance, which, like it or not, it depends almost, it depends to an enormous degree on the United States' willingness to, you know, participate in this alliance and to provide the leadership that we've always provided and that I think is our obligation in this world, to provide that leadership, to be that beacon of freedom and democracy. By the way, my wife and I went to see Hamilton last night, and it reminded me just how much previous generations, going all the way back to the 1700s, have fought for and have worked hard to create and maintain this democracy. And it just reminded me that, you know, how fragile it is in the end. It could be, we could be sitting here a year from now talking about a very different country if we don't make the right decision in a couple of weeks.
Well, we have a race that is being characterized in dark terms by both sides. And we'll talk with Quinn and Bob more about where we are. We have another segment with them, and we will go to the phones, 877-217-5757. But when we come back, we'll start with an inquiry by a listener about how the parties are now upside down based on historical trends. Democrats are going after college-educated whites and Republicans. Trump, he's going after labor. What is going on? We'll talk about it with Bob and Quinn when we return. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We are 13 days from the finish line. In politics, much can happen in 13 days, but unlike 1980, there will be no final debate in the last week in which Ronald Reagan swept the floor with Jimmy Carter and turned a close race into a rout. This one shapes up as a close race that comes down to turnout, and it is a case in which both candidates, for obviously different reasons, would be difficult to elect against a different kind of Republican or a different kind of Democrat. Harris, probably because she is an exotic candidate who's viewed as being liberal from San Francisco, from California. And, of course, she is black, Asian, and female, and that is historically not the way we elect presidents of the United States. She's in an interracial marriage. She is married to a Jewish man. All of these things, nothing wrong with them, but people in this country, believe it or not, are prejudiced, and those things affect elections, and elections are won at the margins. And Trump is like nobody else we've ever seen. He has more divorces than any president in American history and more than all the others put together. And he, of course, is now a convicted felon who awaits trial in three other venues. But he is the favorite to win with 13 days to go, and he's won once before. But Trump is going after undereducated whites, not uneducated, but people without a college degree. And nothing wrong with that. But many of them are in the labor unions whose leadership is supportive largely of Harris, but the work and file workers in this country, white workers, are with Trump. And white educated college professors and others, even in the business world, the more educated you are, the more likely it is, based on polls, to vote for Kamala Harris. And this is much different than what happened with Ronald Reagan, for example. Quinn, how do you explain this turnaround, if you will, in American politics?
Well, it's in some ways personality driven, but I think it's always been a lot more fluid than people have thought. I mean, look, Reagan did great among blue collar workers. He did fantastically well, and some of that hung over to the first election of the first George Bush. This is a cultural thing that where it's more about which candidate seems to strike a chord with a particular cultural subgroup than it is based on anything ideological. That's how I see it. And right now Trump has struck a chord with blue collar workers and the like. But also the Democratic Party has brought in somebody who is culturally of the left. His parents were in a radical group in college, et cetera, et cetera. And so she is sort of strengthening their trend toward being in the sort of coastal elite bubble. That could all change four years from now if you have different candidates.
Bob, what do you make of the fact that Democrats are now getting votes in places they traditionally have not, and Republicans are at least Trump is getting votes from working class Democrats who, Quinn's right, Reagan cracked that wall, but other Republicans like Romney, for example, who was a good candidate, but he didn't have that kind of appeal, that kind of cachet with lunch pail guys. Your thoughts, Bob?
Well, I basically agree with Quinn, I think, on a lot of it. You mentioned Reagan, and I think it's worth just pointing out. I speak as a biographer of Ronald Reagan, by the way, that Ronald Reagan would, and his, for example, his positions on immigration would be anathema to the Trump coalition, the MAGA crowd today. Reagan was, I think if you read some of Reagan's early speeches from the 1950s, and even in parts of, in later in his career, he was as close to an open borders person as you're going to find in the Republican Party. He believed in legal immigration, but he believed in wide open doors to anyone who wanted to come here legally and not only that, to encourage people. And I think one of the reasons for Trump's success, sadly, is that he's exploited the other side of that and gone into some pretty dark places, and we've all seen that. I don't really need to repeat a lot of what he said just in the last few weeks about immigrants and the fear that he's tried to stoke. And I think the press has not covered itself in glory at a lot of junctures in this and doing the job they should do to debunk some of this or to educate their readers and viewers about the real situations in places like Aurora and Springfield. But I think that Trump is just, he's playing to fears of people, and fear in politics is a pretty powerful tool. And I think that we're seeing in Trump someone who's never, probably no one's used it as skillfully in American politics as Trump has.
877-217-5757, your number. Patrick in Innisfail Estates, you're first up. Please be brief. You're on with Bob and Quinn. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, it's probably because the Democrats cater to communist China, which is slave labor, and we're not making things here in America anymore ever since Bill Clinton opened up things in 2000 with his act. But let me get to my question. I'm really upset about how Rudy Giuliani has been sued of everything he owns. People killed in car accidents get less money than these election workers. So anyone who questions an election or looks into it, they're going to be sued out of their life's worth or put in jail. That's ridiculous.
All right. There's a MAGA Republican in Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Bob, are you amused or confused or angered by his remarks?
Well, I'll just say about Giuliani, he was found he defamed an American corporation that sued him for defamation for the damage that he did to their reputation, suggesting that they were complicit in stealing an election that we all know was conducted fairly. I don't know whether the judgment was right or wrong, but I know that the legal remedy is there for any of us. And an American corporation that did this. This wasn't some leftist organization that decided to sue him. This was a bunch of businessmen who decided to sue him to protect their company's reputation. So I don't know that I'll leave it up to the jury system, but I have confidence that a jury and a judge fairly assessed that situation and rendered a fair verdict that's probably been reviewed by appeals courts. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll probably stand based on what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, Quinn, you hear more than a few people, I'm sure, in Mobile, Alabama, who sound a lot like Patrick in Innisfail Estates, a sincere man, but he has... He has bought the message from Donald Trump, and he's an intelligent man. These aren't all dummies. Many people are far more intelligent than I am who like Trump a lot. What do you make of this phenomenon that is Donald Trump?
Well, whether I make of the phenomenon of Trump or whether I make of the stolen election, things are
well, that's part of
things.
It. That's part of it. But
Okay. Let me address the stolen election thing, because unlike a lot of Democrats who will only admit it privately but then absolutely denounce the idea publicly, I absolutely insist that voter fraud happens. It's real. It's documented. It changes elections. I've documented it. And I've had Democratic consultants tell me privately, oh, yeah, of course we know that we're getting some benefit from illegal voting. That said, every absolute actual conservative expert that I know, people who have been beating this drum that I just said about how much vote fraud is real, but the honest ones have all said that there was nowhere near enough vote fraud or other anomalies to have switched the 2020 election. Let me repeat that. These are people who are on the anti-vote fraud side, who have documented vote fraud, who are conservative, who I have dealt with for years, and they say there was not enough of it to have changed this, that the last election. It is just an absolute lie that that election was stolen, and more conservatives need to say that.
All right. Paul in Magnolia Woods, please be brief, Paul. We're about to go to a break. We'll try to get a few words from you if we can. Go. Tell you what, Paul, Robin and Renee tell me we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with you and Quinn and Bob. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana on the 99th anniversary of the birth of John William Kit Carson, the host of The Tonight Show for 30 years, his lawyer and one-time best friend, Henry Bushkin, is on deck, but we're spending a few more minutes with Bob Mann and Quinn Hillier as we talk about the election of 2024, 13 days away, and Paul in Magnolia Woods, please be brief. You're on with Quinn and Bob. Hi, Paul. Good morning, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's your question?
Yes. I've been reading Nate Silver's book, and I understand that people in Las Vegas are often betting against the person they register to support. Can you tell me anything about that?
All right. Bob, you want to bite on that one?
The only thing I will say is that the people who I respect who have looked at that whole betting market thing, and Peter Thiel and some rich, very wealthy friends of Donald Trump are playing around in that, and they've got a lot of money to spend. And I don't trust the polls, but I trust the polls a lot more than the betting market at this point, because I think there's some funny business going on down there. And, you know, in the end, it doesn't really matter. At this point, I think we just got to assume that, as Quinn said very well, it's on a knife's edge and it can go either way. And if you really care about one candidate or another, get out and vote for them.
All right. Final caller for Quinn and Bob, David in Atlanta. David, I think you have a question for Quinn.
Yes, gentlemen, my question is, when Trump said recently on the Fox News channel that the Civil War, fighting the Civil War did not make sense, was Trump further exposing his not-so-cloaked-or-disguised racism favoring slavery like the Republican nominee for governor of North Carolina?
All right, Quinn, what do you make of Trump's remarks on race? He's made numerous remarks, as has the nominee for the Republicans in North Carolina running for governor. Your thoughts?
Well, I actually do think Trump is a bigot, which is one reason why I can never vote for him. But I think those remarks were not racist in nature. I think those remarks were just historical ignorance. I mean, there's so many reports of him just having no knowledge of history whatsoever. John Kelly, his former chief of staff, the general, came out just yesterday, I think it was, saying that he had no idea who Rommel was, the famous German general in World War II, and on and on and on. The guy just doesn't know what he's talking about, and so he just spurts whatever comes to his mind. So that's what I think that was about.
Bob, final remarks from you today from London. Where are we? Where are we? Who's going to win? What do you think?
If I had $10 to put down on somebody, I would probably put it on Harris, only because, you know, Trump and the Republican Party nationally have lost every election since he won in 2016. He has a very high floor, low ceiling, and I just don't see him. I can't imagine that he's gained a lot of voters in the last 4 years, and especially in the last 4 weeks. So, and I also, as I said earlier, I think that reproductive rights, the issue of abortion and women voting to restore and gain back their rights, is going to be a lot more powerful than I think the press in general is counting on.
Well, Quinn, you said it could be 269-269. If you had to choose a winner right now, who's your choice as far as who you think is likely to prevail on November 5th?
Wow. Every hour I change my prediction. So I mean it's that close. So basically I'm making no prediction other than that we probably won't know for at least 3 or 4 days after the election. That's my prediction.
All right, then you're predicting a close one. Thank you, Quinn. Thank you, Bob. And now we segue to Henry Bushkin, the biographer of the great book about John William Carson. It was called Johnny Carson, arguably the most prominent and popular personality in the history of television. Johnny Carson, born on this date, October 23rd, 1925, Corning, Iowa. He grew up in Nebraska, but he had some time in Mississippi and in Louisiana, as Henry Bushkin has noted in previous appearances. And for those of us who watched him, 1962 to 92, as host of The Tonight Show, he will live in our hearts and minds forevermore. And good morning again, Henry. Always a pleasure to catch up with you. And remember, the king of late night, Johnny Carson.
Thanks, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be with you, particularly on Johnny's birthday.
Well, he would have been 99. He died at 79. He had a full life, shall we say, and included a stint at the end of World War II. And he was a man who, I think the one thing people may not realize is that he had an amazing intellect. And as you said on a previous show, he was already wealthy as a teenager when he was a student at Millsaps. He would come to New Orleans and he knew how to count cards. And he was staying at the Monteleone and dining at Commander's Palace with a girlfriend when he was 18 years old, wasn't he?
Exactly, and it's hard for, I think, the current generation of people to understand that he spent a weekend in New Orleans in 1940, I think the beginning of 1946, for $35, hotel and food included.
That is amazing, but Arnold Palmer won the Baton Rouge Open, which was part of the PGA Tour in 1960, and got $2,000, so... We have had a tad bit of inflation, but when Johnny was growing up, and his childhood was not idyllic, as we know, based on your findings about his tortured relationship, particularly with his mother, he was known as Kit Carson, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he grew up. His father was known as Kit Carson when Johnny was born, and as a young guy, they started calling him Kit Carson. Indeed, when he joined the Navy in 1945, he signed in as Kit Carson. He was never known as Johnny Carson until 1946, when the battleship Pennsylvania pulled into Guam for repairs. It was torpedoed at the end of World War II. And Carson was the youngest officer on board, and he had the job of collecting, pardon me, the dead sailors who were killed during the torpedo event the day before. So he was a very young officer, but everybody called him Kit Carson, and it wasn't until 1946, during some boxing matches aboard the U.S. the Pennsylvania, when it was in Guam, and he was a middleweight boxer, and during one fight with a guy he was supposed to lose to, he wins with a lucky punch, and all of a sudden to the whole crew he's known as Johnny One Punch, because he beat a guy by the name of Maybe Tucker, a black dude from Texas, who was a mate. You know, black guys in World War II were either in the kitchen or doing remedial duties. I mean, that's all they did then. Of course, it's quite different now. But Johnny and this guy, Maybe Tucker, became lifelong friends until 1984. But the point is that after that fight on the battleship Pennsylvania, he was known as Johnny, and Kit Carson was no longer. So that's an interesting fact for people that look at the history of World War II, and there were lots of guys like Johnny who were patriots. Who Johnny signed up in 1945 when he was 17 years old. He thought he was going to become a pilot, and of course they stopped that VL-5 deal in because they had enough pilots, and that's how we became an ensign in the Navy.
All right. Now, we will go to the phone lines, and then we have some, a little bit more time with Henry Bushkin, Johnny Carson's lawyer. And at one time, Johnny said Henry was his best friend, and they were inseparable for many years. And Carson always, or not always, but often referred to Henry on the show as the bombastic Bushkin. But a listener, notes about Johnny. You, on a previous show, said that he quite likely had CTE based on his experiences in the ring as a soldier in the Navy. He took some shots as well as he gave them, and sometimes it only takes a couple of hard-fought bouts to make an impression on somebody years later.
And I think medical history will show that CTE often shows up 15 to 20 years after the fact. So Johnny was doing these fights in 1946. He had 10 three-round bouts in 1946. And around 1965, 1966, which was sort of the early years of The Tonight Show, when he was doing The Tonight Show, he started developing headaches, mood swings, drinking, and others believe that this was a result of the boxing events in 1946 that showed up 20 years later. And I believe anybody who really knew Johnny in the late 40s and the early 50s up until the mid 60s will say he was the type of guy you'd like to hang out with. He was that funny. He was that sharp. He was that interesting. And when headaches and mood swings happen in the mid 60s, I believe that led to the ultimate decline. And by 1992, by the time he retired or left The Tonight Show, the CTE was really a problem because he was isolated, he was insulated, and he was not heard from.
We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we certainly elicit your support. We have started our fall member drive, and if you're so inclined, please give us a call, 877-217-5757 for the show. And as always, if you call to show your support in a tangible way for WRKF, the number for the radio station to show your support and benevolence is 855-893-9753. Thank you so much for your contribution. You can also go to WRKF.org anytime, day or night. Henry Bushkin with us, and when we went to the break, he was talking about his friend Johnny Carson, and Henry wrote the best-selling book about Carson in 2013, Johnny Carson, and who succeeded Jack Parr in 1962 as host of The Tonight Show and had a 30-year reign in television unprecedented for its popularity, staying power, and he was still highly popular at the end of his tenure, even though he was only working 40 weeks a year, three nights a week. But he decided that was enough. And Henry, as we hit the break, you were saying that the reason he didn't come back wasn't necessarily because he felt like he'd done all he could do, was he was having some difficulties based on the head trauma he received in World War II as a boxer. You think that made a mark on him that shortened his life and made his life really less palatable in his final years? Why?
Absolutely, and I think it's still an ongoing study about CTE and traumatic brain injury. But again, 15 or 20 years later, it usually shows up. I think that's what medical studies show. And when I first started representing Johnny in 1970, I had no idea, I don't think anybody did, about his boxing career 20 or 25 years earlier. And his mood swings, his temperament, and so on, was quite difficult. And I think anybody who knew Johnny during those days knew it was difficult dealing with him at times, because he could be irritable, he could be sort of nasty, and on the show he was always brilliant. So that goes to show what a great sort of entertainer he was, because he was suffering.
John on Stumberg's been waiting. John, I want to slide you in with Henry Bushkin. You have the floor, my friend.
Good morning. First off, an outstanding book. I still have it, and I've read it a couple times, actually. You mentioned the CTE issues. Would you say that that started to really take effect in a greater way by the mid-60s, when he had his first big disputes with NBC and even walked out for an extended period of time?
What about how it affected his negotiations, which ultimately led to his departure from The Tonight Show?
Oh, I don't think it really had any effect on his negotiations over the years, because he had, before me, he had lawyers, he had accountants who would basically do the negotiating. But by the time that he retired in 92, it wasn't exactly a retirement. He was effectively pushed out by NBC, because they thought, and personally, after all these years, I agree, that the last 4 or 5 years of the show, nothing changed. It was the same show. There was nothing new. And all the creative energy that went into The Tonight Show really started in the early 60s. And by 1988, the show had there was nothing new on the show. It was still brilliant. It was still getting great ratings. But there was nothing new. And by 1992, I think NBC figured it's time for someone else. I don't know that he would have left voluntarily or not, because I wasn't there. But I don't think he just retired. I think he was pushed out.
All right. We lost Michael downtown, but several people want to talk with Henry, and hopefully we'll have him back soon. And I know you have written what amounts to a second book, and I know some publishers who probably would like it, because I think you have more information that is in the second to be published book, Henry, that is new. We knew some of the things about Carson that you wrote about so brilliantly in 2013, but you found some things that nobody knew about him, and I think he is still relevant all these years later.
Well, I think I may need you as my new agent.
Well, Jim Brown is a big book publisher in Louisiana, and I know he's a big fan of Johnny Carson, so maybe we can get him, Lisburn Press, to do Johnny Carson round two.
Why not? I think I'll get in touch with you after this, and maybe we'll see about that.
I would love that, because I've read, Henry sent me much of his material, and it is really, really good stuff that is worthy of another book. But we'll be calling again, and it's always great to catch up with my friend by virtue of our affinity, and you knew him personally, knew him better than anybody, I believe, Johnny Carson, Henry Bushkin. You are quite a force of nature yourself. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Jim, and I'll be in touch. I appreciate it.
Talk to you soon. And we're joined now in our remaining moments by Jake Morgan. He heads the Baton Rouge Firefighters Association, and if you've been following the November 5th election, there is a big item on the ballot involving a millage for the firefighters. The current starting salary of a Baton Rouge firefighter is $33,207 a year. That's 20% less than firefighters in similar cities in the Southeast make. So, Jake Morgan, why do you believe this millage is necessary? It's a 10-year, 6-mil property tax proposal that would give BRFD about $14.5 million a year. Why do you think a yes vote is essential for the stability of the firefighters and for the community at large?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Jim, for having me. So our firefighters have fallen behind on pay, which affects our ability to recruit and retain our quality firefighters. That's what this proposition is all about. You spoke on our starting salary, which is roughly 20% less than industry standard in our state and in the Southeast region. Our proposition, if passed, would bring us to that standard. We have proposed $6 million property millage to be used solely and exclusively for our salaries, giving our firefighters a much-needed pay raise. This proposed millage would close that pay gap, prioritize our city's public safety, and allow us to recruit and retain the best firefighters in the state. So we ask you vote yes. The title of our millage is kind of vague. I'm not sure why it landed on that, but it's titled City of Baton Rouge 6 Mills MC 10 Years. So it's at the bottom of the ballot. It's a lengthy ballot. I know we got a lot going on. But this is the first time we've asked the public for new revenue in 24 years. So almost a quarter of a century. We have not asked for any type of dedicated revenue for the firefighters. But how we've gotten here is we've gone round and round with the city administration, doing our homework, our due diligence to try and find these new funds to pay our firefighters with. But the money's simply not. It's not there. It's not like it's sitting in an account waiting for mm-hmm. a raise. The city administration, they're focused on fixing a budget deficit right now, right? So you just had the creation of the city of St. George. That took a lot of tax dollars away from the parish general fund, and they're focusing on balancing a new budget with less money. So they're not looking to give out money currently. So this is us trying to fix our problems. This has been a year in the coming. But we understand we're not the only profession in need of a pay raise.
You've done this 12 years now.
Yes, sir.
You started young, Catholic High guy. When did you become a firefighter?
I became a firefighter in the year 2012.
How old were you?
Oh, I was 21 going on 22.
So you're still a young man. If I do my math, that means you're like 33 or 34 now,
That's
right?
That's exactly right, 34.
34 years old and already head of the Firefighters Union in Baton Rouge. We often, it's a cliche, but we take firefighters for granted until we need one.
That's right.
And when we need one, it's often a dangerous occupation. What about the people who are career firefighters? What's their life like through the years as they go to work not knowing what they're going to experience every day?
You can imagine how it can be stressful. You're talking a 30, 35-year career from a young man to a middle-aged man. When we do have to go and work and save lives and run into burning buildings, it's extremely, extremely difficult on your human body. So a lot of stress, poor sleep habits. We work 24-hour shifts. So, we might be sleeping at the fire station. Sometimes you got good nights, and sometimes you got bad nights where you don't sleep at all. So everybody knows now through sleep studies how bad disrupted sleep is for you. The smoke we breathe now puts us at a higher risk for cancer when we're around these fires. So it's just a very demanding career. And right now we're just trying to get our pay up to where our guys don't have to continue mm-hmm. working two and three jobs, just to make a simple ends meet. The fire schedule that we work is set up to work other jobs. That's what we sign up to do. But we're just trying to catch up to industry standard pay.
Well, and a listener has noted that you would have been 11 years old when 9/11 happened.
Yes, sir.
And we certainly remember the heroism of firefighters then. Never know when you're going to be called into action, and many of them gave their lives.
Yes, sir. Ultimate sacrifice.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely do. Yeah, that was a pivotal moment in my childhood. Certainly put the fire service on the map for me. And then when I became a young adult, it just spoke to me. And I've loved every minute of it, and I'm so proud to do what I do.
Well, Jake Morgan, I have a feeling you're going to be a big guy in labor in Louisiana as a whole. But you're the head of the Firefighters Union at 34, and he's saying vote yes. A lot of people, of course, are wary of taxes, and for good reason. But I would say that this might be one that I think most people will accept. And you say it's been 24 years?
24 years since we've asked for new money. That's right.
All right. Well, good luck to you. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.